Good morning, everyone. I'm Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the September 30, 2014 edition of Ask a Leader. I'm welcoming all anteaters to this brand new academic year. All you new students, returning students, this is the place, this is the dial for your listening pleasure and your edification. When we're not spinning the tunes on the platter over our 24/7 schedule, we offer a wide array of public affairs programming, weekdays from 8 to 10 and 4 to 6 p.m. Hope you enjoy what you hear and that you let us know what you think. Deal? Okay, deal. Today's show has been in the works for months, and my guest wanted to wait till you all were back in session. It's my pleasure to devote the whole hour to three women who've left their religious past, that is, they've left Islam, Christian fundamentalism, and Hasidic Judaism. They are Haina Dadaboy, Sarah Jones, and Chani Getter, respectively. Don't go away. We'll be right back after the station break. Thank you, everybody, for joining me here on Ask a Leader. My guests for the whole hour today are Haina Dadaboy, Sarah Jones, and Chani Getter, three women who have come out, who have summoned over time unimaginable courage to step out of the religious doctrines of their respective childhoods. Each one has chosen increasingly public profiles in their individuation process. Each one of them has a portfolio which admittedly could take up this whole hour. However, I wanted instead to provide an opportunity for all of us to examine the red thread that stitches their narratives together and certainly the red pencil that draws those distinctions as well. First is Haina Dadaboy, a web developer who lives here in Orange County, California, who was raised in an Islamic home. As an atheist feminist, secular humanist, Haina has been an active participant in atheist organizations and events in and around Orange County since 2007 and on the national stage since 2011. She's currently writing A Skeptic's Guide to Islam and blogs on a freethoughtblogs.com under the subsection Heinous Dealings, and you'll see the tab there. It's a delightful plan words. Haina completed her BA in English and Philosophy here at UCI. Our second guest, Chani Getter, is a program operations coordinator at Footsteps, a nonprofit organization that assists people in their transition from a life apart and beyond ultra-Orthodox Judaism. She also provides additional life coach support through Inspirational Living Incorporated. Chani grew up in an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jewish home and was married off at age 18. As a 23-year-old with her minimal secondary education, Chani left her arranged marriage with her three children. As a single working parent, Chani then herself put herself through college, earned her BA in Human Development from Empire State College, and completed certification later as a life coach. She also received ordination from One Spirit Interfaith Seminary. Our third and our final guest is Sarah Jones, who works in communications at Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Originally from Bristol, Virginia, Sarah completed her Bachelor of Arts in International Studies and Bible from Cedarville University in Cedarville, Ohio, and her master's degree in postcolonial culture and global policy from Goldsmiths, University of London. While with Femin Ijtihad, Sarah researched Islamic law and women's rights. She also interned with Three Faiths Forum in London, England. Her coverage and commentary on world and political religious news has been published in Religion News Service, On Faith, Mufta Magazine, among others. She's also presented original research in religious movements and postcolonial theory at the London School of Economics and Florida Atlantic University. She's joined up with pro-choice activists and Homeschoolers Anonymous. Today, Honey comes to us from Rockland County, New Jersey, Sarah Jones from Washington, D.C., and Hannah Dadaboy joins me in studio. It is a pleasure and an honor. Welcome to all of you ladies on the show.
Thank you for having
That's
us.
That's Hannah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Sarah and Honey there. I'd first like, here's like the big one. They're all big questions, I think. I hope I've got captured all. I'd like to first, and we can start with Honey, so she's starts to know that she's up first here. And you'll each one of you can say, we'll get used to each one of your three voices, but I'll label them as we're starting here. First, I'd like for each one of you to talk about when you first began questioning the belief system of the religion of your upbringing. When did you begin to doubt your devout convictions? Hannah?
Oh, okay. I didn't grow up terribly religious until I was about 5 years old, and my parents got religious when I was around that age. So I always sort of had a different frame of reference from sort of more strict practices and interpretations of Islam. I always knew that there were other ways, but my parents got religious when I was around 5, and I joined in with them, becoming more religious than they. And it was one of those things where those who I knew who were a little bit less aware of Islam and a little bit less well-read in Islam didn't really know about the parts that bothered me, the parts that could really cause doubt. But, you know, I managed to keep the doubts suppressed. I wouldn't say that 9/11, which was, by the way, my second day of high school as a teenager. I wouldn't say that it really caused me to doubt or leave Islam, but it did cause me to research it more because my peers who were non-Muslims, I went to high school locally here, were asking me questions, and they weren't being jerks about it or anything. They were just curious. And all that research led me to find out more and more. When I entered university here at UCI, I took History of Medieval Philosophy, and that was essentially at the time, I don't know if it's still taught the same way, it was centered around the writings of Augustine. And I realized that Christianity had a very similar basis for its theology as Islam did, and yet somehow they end up in completely different places. So for me, it was a matter of figuring out that other forms of theism almost had the exact same logical basis, and yet somehow they end up not only on different sides of things, but killing each other over it. So that's really where my serious doubts started.
How about Sarah? Shall we go next to you?
Sure. So I had a fairly isolated upbringing. Out of 12 years of lower education, I spent 3 of those in public school. Everything else, I was being homeschooled or I was at a fundamentalist Christian school. So I wasn't exposed to a lot of information that could even feed doubts for a long time. But once I was starting around in junior high and high school, I did start to have some doubts. And by the time I entered college, which was a very conservative Christian school, I was at least deviating from the right-wing politics that I had been raised with, favoring a more liberal and feminist interpretation of Christianity. And eventually it was while I was at college that I realized that I just, didn't believe in God at all anymore.
Well, one thing I want to backtrack a little bit is that in some of your writings on your blogging and all that, you say that it was in the New York Times coverage about you at Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, with the Hobby Lobby case that you're watching, is that you were settling with what you thought was a reasonable kind of religious school, and so there's a dynamism already in play here with your questioning in your faith.
Right. Christian schools in the United States, they kind of exist on a spectrum where you have everything from Bob Jones University and Pensacola Christian, which are extraordinarily fundamentalist schools, to ones that are more progressive or, at least moderate. And when I was looking at colleges, Cedarville did have a reputation for being one of the more reasonable, if not necessarily liberal, schools. And so I thought I was getting an experience where I would at least be able to ask all these questions that I had about my faith in an intellectual environment. And, of course, if you've read the New York Times story, you found, that that was very much not the case.
Right. And we may have an opportunity. We've got such such to cover today. Connie, why don't you please answer? Your answer is a little bit different because of your relationship with Hasidic Jewry at this point. But how would you answer the question about what first had you questioning the tradition in which you were raised?
So to answer that question, I would have to say that my marriage didn't work. And there I was with 3 children and no education and no way to earn a living. And so when the system stopped working, I started questioning more than that. Because I grew up in a Hasidic environment, we basically have shtetls, which are like these little enclaves of people. Where I grew up, we had grocery stores that were separate, Hasidic, and hardware stores and dress shops, and we basically had a little village that was, you know, just the only people I saw were Hasidim or different kind of Jews, which were like still all of them Orthodox in one form or another. And so the only thing that I really saw was different kind of Orthodoxy. I went to school 12 years, you know, my entire high school with the same kind of kids. We went through high school, we went from, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade in the same environment. We had censored books. If we did read anything English, it was censored. English was my second language. And so my life was extremely insular, and I didn't know anything other than. And although even if I kind of felt maybe that I did not want to get married, which I didn't, I didn't know that there was an option not to, and I didn't really know how to say that. So at 17, my marriage was arranged. I met this young man once, and we were married. I was not taught anything about birth control, and so within 11 months, I had my son, and then two daughters after that. My marriage didn't work, and I had to leave. And so here I was, single mom at 23, and the system failed me, a system that is there really to protect us and to take care of us and all of these other things that I was taught it would do, which it did when my mom had cancer. We received food was brought to our home. My father doesn't drive, and so different people drove them into the hospital. There was always somebody, even people we didn't know. The community itself is built in a way that we were taken care of. But then the system failed. Once the system failed, I began to question a lot more than that. I questioned whether anything I did had a purpose, whether the Torah, which is the Old Testament in English, whether that was real or true, and what does that mean, and whether the interpretation that the rabbis had created through generations were real, and what does it mean even that it was real or not real, and how do we interpret text and all of that. And so I began to question everything simply because the system had failed me. I do believe that there's a higher power that guides us. It's one of the reasons I chose to become an interfaith minister, because I grew up in this enclave that I grew up in. Not only is it so insular, but there's this message that we receive, which is we're better than anybody else. And I didn't believe that, but it's the only thing I knew. And so as I was leaving and kind of trying to figure out what that meant, the more I learned, the more I realized, I believe what Hannah said was that, you know, all of these traditions that we study or that people practice are really all based on so much of the same ideology. And so what I've done in my life is incorporate all of these different traditions into my life in some form or another, because I love tradition. I grew up with tremendous amount of ritual. I grew up with ritual from the morning, from the moment I woke up until the moment I went to sleep. And there's this kind of saying that you might have heard, which is, you know, you can take the girl out of the Chassid town, like you can take the girl out of Rockland, anyway, but you can't take Rockland out of the girl, right? And
right.
So here I am, and I've been built and raised with so much ritual in my life that I just love it. I create different meanings for the rituals that I do. I do different rituals that I've done growing up, and yet I do some of the same. And our home is filled with ritual, some of which are Jewish and some of which are not. And even the ones that are Jewish, perhaps we do in a different way. For example, this past weekend was Rosh Hashanah, and
yes,
we had a group of 20 people at our table. And so we did all of these different rituals and just created different meanings for them. So I think I'm still in the process of that. And yet at the same time, the moment I started questioning was the moment that the system had failed me.
I want to get, yes, honey, and Sarah, I would like for the two of you to talk to each other about the insularity in which you were raised. Hena had much more exposure. I think there is a distinction for her from the two of you, but the insularity in where you were raised, in what was expected of you, and like even to the extent Sarah, she's now doing Homeschooling Anonymous, but the homeschooling and those fundamentalist Christian schools also had their own kind of insularity. So Hani is talking about, does that have some resonance with what your early experience was and your questions that you were starting to have somehow in your insularity?
Certainly to an extent. There are some obvious differences, I would say. But just looking particularly at my early years when I was being homeschooled, I didn't see anyone who didn't belong to my family unless I was at church. And even then at church, it was the same people over and over again. And that was maybe, you know, 1 to 3 times a week. That was it. So I have, you know, no pop culture references. I have, you know, the 90s is not something I really experienced. I lived through it. I didn't experience it. And as I got older and started to move like towards a fundamentalist Christian school, and even eventually in public school, my experience of the outside world was always filtered through a very restrictive lens. So it's taken quite a bit of adjustment to move past that insularity and just develop basic social skills and be able to, you know, kind of survive in mainstream academic and professional environments.
Hena, did you want to add something?
I didn't mention this, but I think I may have been given the wrong impression of my background. Until high school, I was entirely religiously schooled,
okay,
including a year in London in a very strict all-girls school, where despite the fact that it was all girls, we all had to cover our heads and wear a certain uniform and all that. So I really relate to what Sarah's saying about not getting the pop culture references. Grunge is something I don't understand. For example, that never happened for me. So, yeah, no, it's tough. I mean, I've managed to pick up a lot and I play catch up. I joke that, you know, Netflix is now my culture school and I go there and I watch everything that everyone else talks about. But, you know, it's difficult. There are certain gaps in my knowledge and that can be tough, too.
And I know, Hani, from what I've been reading with a lot of lovely memoirs about Hasidic Jewish women, that there were things right down to even one's anatomy. In particular case, Deborah Feldman, who wrote Unorthodox, that she had no idea. She didn't know that she had a vagina, and she only knew about it because she was getting training prior to her wedding. And then they were trying to explain to her. They gave her some sort of very abstract kind of mechanic kinds of lessons and that kind of thing. But I don't know, Hani, if you wanted to address some of what your insularity meant in terms of lack of pop culture and lack of all things.
So I think lack of pop culture for sure. I'm still catching up. I've left the community 14 years ago. I mean, I'm still catching up. I have kids who are teenagers who make references that I have no idea what they're talking about. And it's like, oh, yeah, you know, mom. And there are certain things that I'll never understand. The difference between music and what's what is, like, so foreign to me. I knew one kind of music, and that was Hasidic music. And so even if I like certain music, I don't know what I like. Like, I don't know the genre of what I like. I just know that I like this.
Okay.
Which is really frustrating. We'll sit around the table, and every so often when I think I finally got it, I realize how far I don't. I just don't have it, and I don't understand what's going on. In terms of my body, I mean, after my first child, I went into a library, which, considering where it was located, was really kind of more of a censored library. I mean, it was definitely the state, you know, it was a county library, but it basically was serving the Hasidic community, but my family was a little bit stricter than strict, and so I wasn't allowed in there. But I went in there and I took out a book about my anatomy to figure out how I was getting pregnant and how I can stop that.
That's after your first pregnancy.
This is after I had my child, and I had my child. This is after I had my child, after I had him completely naturally, because I'm kind of a little bit crazy like that. So I read up about pregnancy. I knew what was happening to my body because I'm fascinated by biology. And so I knew what was happening to my body, and I also understood mechanically how I got pregnant. I mean, that wasn't the case. The issue was that I didn't understand what my body was doing to encourage that, because my question was, and that's why I walked into the library, because my question was, everyone's having sex. How come they're not getting pregnant? Like, there must be something people are doing that's stopping this from happening. And so I took out a book to figure that out. I mean, here I was, 20 years old, with a child, and I had no idea what my body was doing. And that was still me, very much in the community, yet still, in some ways, questioning already. And I think that the more I think about it, the more I realize how much I had questioned before. But, for example, another piece of where my kind of insularity was really, really palpable is I'm gay. And here I was kissing girls, my best friends. I was in an all-girls school. We never had any contact with boys. As soon as we hit 12 or they hit 13, we were not allowed to be next to them. And even in younger ages, we only played with, our cousins and our next-door neighbors. But once we hit that age, like once the girls were 12 or the boys were 13, we were totally segregated. And so here I am, kissing girls as a teenager, and I don't even know that what I'm doing means anything other than, because I have no words for what's happening. I have absolutely no words for what's happening. And I don't understand that most women want to do that with guys. So we're sitting in synagogue, and we're looking over the mechitza, which is like this divider, and my friends are there, and they're all kind of choosing which boy they think is cute. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, ugh, you guys are so immature. Like, this is what we're talking about. And this is regular teenage behavior. We're 15 years old. They're all kind of looking at which guy is cute. And then finally, one of them nudges me, and it's like, hey, honey, who do you think is cute? And I had to find somebody, so I found this guy. And, like, all of them turn to me and say, ugh, he looks like a girl.
Wow. Well, and honey, in some of your own materials, you talked about your awareness of being, you didn't know the word was, but at 14, you said, honestly, I didn't know that we were supposed to love men. I thought we just had to have children with them. So with all those frames of references not there, it must have been odd. You didn't know to be lonely, but maybe you felt lonely and odd.
You know, I wasn't lonely because I really didn't know that I was different. Nobody talked about attraction. I had no concept of knowing that people were actually attracted to their partners. In Hasidic communities, men and women do not touch, even husband and wife in front of their kids. It's all done in the bedroom. And so I didn't understand that there was... I had never seen a movie, ever. I'd never seen things that would make me think that there was some sort of attraction between a man and a woman, because everything needed to look proper. And I truly believed that, you know, you get married to a guy and you have these feelings that I have for women, not realizing how different I was. I think that by the time I started realizing how different I was kind of in my early 20s before I left. And that's when the loneliness set in, when I started realizing that my friends were actually attracted to their husbands, even if they didn't use those words. I started kind of, there were little hints that they dropped that had me thinking that. And it was like, oh, wow, this is interesting. And here I am pining and having feelings for them.
Okay. For those of you listeners who've just joined us, my guests for the whole hour are Haina Dadaboy, Sarah Jones, and Hani Getter, talking about their leaving the orthodoxy of Islam, Christian fundamentalism, and Hasidic Judaism, respectively, on Ask a Leader on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and streaming the world round in synagogues, mosques, sanctuaries all over the world on the web at KUCI.org. And I want to get to this, have Sarah, perhaps she may have some reactions to some of this when we're talking about there's emotional literacy, there's pop cultural literacy, there's all these things that are sort of missing in this insularity. I didn't know if you wanted to add anything more to that before I move on to the emotional literacy in specific with Hannah. Did you, Sarah, want to say anything more to add here?
Well, just variations on what I've already said, probably. You know, it's just been so difficult to try to catch up, and I feel like there is a lot that I missed out on. And I think sometimes that it can sound like a very superficial thing to not have in your life, oh, pop culture references or, you know, current event references. Those are things that you can learn later, and that's true. But when you transition out of a subculture that's a bit more insular and you're trying to move forward into a more mainstream environment, not having those references can be a real handicap because people are talking about things that you just don't understand, and it can come across like almost a different language at times.
Yes, yes. A whole frame of reference. Well, so Hannah, on your blog, you've expressed that when you first left Islam, your reasons, and I quote, had a lot more to do with theological underpinnings than any ethical or emotional objections to Islam. And you said that you'd hope that those around you, quote, would not only understand why I lost my faith, they might become sympathetic or even end up agreeing with me on some level. Some secret path of me yearned to convince at least one Muslim in my life of the lack of reason behind their faith.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Well, I was 17 and I had, you know, figured out something that I thought no one else had thought of, that, you know, that there were similar underpinnings to the deism of several different faiths that are at odds with each other, you know, Christianity and Islam in this case. And so I thought, if I explain to everybody that this is why I don't believe anymore, you know, this is why I don't follow religion, because it seems like they have the same logic and yet somehow end up in such different places, that I would be able to, you know, get them to understand. Instead, the backlash I received was just as bad as I would have received had I said, hey, mom and dad, I, you know, don't want to be a Muslim anymore because I don't want to wear my headscarf. Because that was my greatest fear. It was people pigeonholing me as this sort of rebel wild girl, which was hilarious that they would, because I was nothing like that. I was entirely straight-laced and obedient. And so I wanted, it was very important to me that people know that that was why I left Islam, but it didn't matter anyway. You know, I had people calling me to explain to me that it was just a phase and I was just going crazy for a while and that I would come back. So that was actually very hurtful to me. And it actually really, that's when really the feelings of isolation and alienation set in, because it wasn't so much that I wasn't a Muslim anymore that isolated me. It was, I felt that nobody understood me.
Well, it stepping out though in these ways that all three of you have, it's there aren't any kind of safety net, social, I don't know, political. So you're, and all three of you are actually, and we're going to get into that a little bit more later, but you're all creating a safety net for those that are in this period doubting their faith and are seeing your contributions emerge on the web and in different places. And I hope that was three different directions to go into here. Well, I want to, then there's a fine line then, all three of you, maybe, especially maybe Hannah and Hani, that there's a fine line between your doubting and critiquing your faith and bringing on sort of a xenophobic response. You're sort of validating the xenophobe. So is that another kind of a tension that you've had to adjust to? And I don't know who wants to take this first, Hannah or Hani?
I guess I'll go ahead, because it actually all started here at UCI. I took a course, it was an interdisciplinary course, and the people in it were advocating a very intense form of cultural relativism, where they believed that, you know, all cultures ought to be respected, all practices within all cultures. And I brought up my own story as an example of why certain things are not to be respected. And they responded with, we're sorry that happened to you, but we have to respect your culture. And I said, when did culture override my right as a human being to choose my life? And so that was sort of a bad tone for it. And initially, as an ex-Muslim, I found the most sympathy with xenophobes, with people who were really eager to have me on their websites and their podcasts and talk about how horrible those brown people are, essentially. And I immediately realized, though, not necessarily immediately, but I very soon realized that I didn't want to be a part of that. So I had to sort of make a decision that would not be the route I would go. And that's why it's been a harder journey to some extent, because the more sympathetic people do lie along the sort of xenophobic right. And I didn't want to have anything to do with that.
Hani, how did you deal with that? Or do you deal with that?
Okay. Do you mind being a little bit more specific in your question?
Well, I think when you're individuating yourself, taking issue with Hasidic Judaism, it's a fine line between what your own nuanced appreciation and critique of what Hasidic Judaism is about, and validating an anti-Semite who just wants to sort of xenophobically sort of dismiss all that the Hasidim and their trappings as they're making their way around their lives.
You know, it's an interesting process, because growing up in the kind of community I think that each of us had, it makes life very much black and white. There's
right.
us and there's them.
Yes.
And there's this kind of life becomes black and white, and I usually joke about the fact that Hasidim only wear black and white, so that like even makes that even, you know, stronger. But that the world has all of these different colors. And there isn't for me, there isn't a right and wrong way to respond to that. It's been difficult, because sometimes people get onto this anti-Semitic rant that then goes into it, and it's still my people and my family, and it's still part of me as well. So all of that kind of comes into play as well. And so when I do talk about it, and when I do have conversations with people, I usually invite them to come into a space that isn't a black and white space, where we can hold all of that which is. Some of the work that I do for Footsteps is I go into mental health clinics and I train people on how to, on the symptoms and just understanding a little bit of the Hasidic community, especially those leaving, and the kind of mental health issues that come along with it, because you come from this environment that is so insular and so protective, and then you're kind of like thrown into this world where you have all these choices, and mentally some people have a really hard time to make these choices.
I can imagine. And,
I mean, simply as what, like, I can wear pants, or for a guy, I can wear anything other than black pants. You know, like any of those kind of decisions, we, you know, in Footsteps we have sometimes mentors, and some of the things that they do is actually go shopping with people, because they just don't know what to wear and kind of all of those different things. Of course, we do a lot more than that in terms of education and other things, but some of the simpler things. So I think that part of where I am with it and what I talk to people about is I present a very dark side of this community. Every community has beautiful things to it, and every community has some really harsh things. And if we were to take American culture and look at it and study it the way we do the cultures of our birth, or at least the way I do the culture of, and the place that I come from, then I would find really good parts of it, but I would also find really harsh parts of it. And so to understand that there isn't just the one way of looking at it, that there's all these different pieces that come along, and that they weave into this pattern that didn't work for me and doesn't work for a whole lot of people for a whole lot of reasons. And I feel if it continues going the way it will, then might crumble onto itself, because it just doesn't work. And because when we create this us and them mentality and this black and white world, we're bound to hurt ourselves in the process, because it's not meant to be. And so it's hard, because people want to kind of jump onto that bandwagon and like, yeah, this is terrible, this is crazy, this and this, and kind of point all of that, but this is not the full picture.
Right.
And it's important to notice that there's so much broader, and that if we're going to put any community under a microscope and kind of look at it that way, that and it's important to study that it's also perhaps important to put that on ourselves and on the greater culture and say, okay, so what aren't we doing that needs help? And perhaps that's part of why I'm an activist, but that's, I think that the stand in the, you know, many people call it the gray areas, but to me it's the colorful areas of life.
Of course. Oh, yeah. That's wonderful. Well,
Yes.
Go ahead, honey. Go ahead.
No. And to note, I was just going to finish that it's just to notice that there's so much more than the black and white and the gray, that there's all these colors, and we can't have a conversation that pigeonholes any person or any community.
That's wonderful. I'm glad that's a wonderful refrain to go back to, and I'd incorporate in my own kind of thinking and pursuing more learning. I would like for all of you to speak to the topic about this tension between belonging and freedom, where religion, especially religious orthodoxy, is concerned. How did you navigate that? I don't know who would like to start with that first. Because that membership had its bennies, but there was a dawning of there's something more. There was a gradual sort of liberating process. You realize there's more choices. There's, in terms of Hasidic Judaism, there was moving out of the language spoken. I can't think of the name right now.
Yiddish.
I don't know why. The insularity meant that there was only Yiddish spoken. So the liberating thing in some of these memoirs cases is that they actually could read a printed word in non-Yiddish texts. And that, so I would like to walk back to that one line about the tension between belonging and freedom, the acquisition of freedom. Who would like to bring that up?
My answer is probably the short. Yeah, my answer is probably the shortest. I never really felt like I belong. I didn't really feel like there was that much of a benefit to being a part of the Muslim community, because I was always kind of this weirdo outsider who would rather read than talk to people and things like that. And so when I left, I left fairly happily. But then I realized after I left that community didn't have to mean social pressure and teasing and suffering. It could mean something else. So I've sort of worked to build my own community and my own sort of chosen family. So that's been a great process, and I've learned the benefits of having a community.
So you were able to acquire at a faster rate than you were shedding that kind of support.
Oh no, it took a while.
Okay.
It wasn't a quick process by any means, but now that I've been out of the faith for, almost 9 years now, I've been able to build my community and my chosen family.
How about you, Sarah? Let's give you a chance to speak in here.
Well, my experience is similar to Hannah's in some ways, where I never quite fit in at my church. I didn't quite fit in with the other homeschoolers. I didn't really fit in at my fundamentalist Christian school. I just didn't talk at the public school. I definitely didn't fit in at my Christian college. So it was my community, but it was only my community because my parents had chosen that for me. It's not something that I chose for myself, which is not to say that it wasn't difficult to leave that behind, or that I worried that I was betraying people that I had cared about or who cared about me. But in the end, it was just so untenable. And I had never quite felt like I fit into it anyway, that, discarding it wasn't maybe as difficult as it could have been otherwise. And I haven't really found a replacement community. I've participated in various ideological movements. I've not found a home in any of them. And so at this point in my life, it's kind of, my community are my friends. Even my relatives, although it's not quite the way they wanted it to be. It's just not so much centered around an ideology anymore, but rather around personal relationships.
My goodness. Oh, Sarah. Hani?
It was difficult. And when you asked me about loneliness, I think I felt it most when I left.
Yes.
It was extremely difficult to move through, and I didn't kind of just leave everything. I had three kids I was raising and needed to maneuver this process a lot more gently, I think, than people without kids can. And so I moved kind of from community into community and always felt like an outsider until I figured out that I could belong to many different communities at the same time and that no one place was going to feed me the way my community of origin did.
Mm.
So I have my queer community and I have my kind of renewal Jewish community and I have my interfaith community and I have all of these different communities that I hold, that I visit, that I am part of, that feed me in all of these different ways that I need to be fed. And they do. And some of these people actually travel in all of, very few, but there are some people who actually kind of visit me in all of these different communities where when I go into one and I see them and they're not in the same, I was like, oh, wow, so good that you're here too.
Because you invited them or they manage,
they move in those movements too? They kind of were called to the same space as I was in. And we have a chosen family, and I love that that was used here because my children talk about it, that they have this huge family and nobody shares their last name. Now my partner and I are together, and so we've kind of adopted this woman who has four little kids, and so they're my children's sister, and they're my children's nieces and nephews, and then we have... friends of mine who are much more than friends, and their children and my children consider themselves cousins, even if they're not related. And my children have grandparents who have taken care of them as grandparents do for years. And we didn't realize we were even forming that bond until somebody said to my son, I think, "Oh, your grandfather's calling you." And my son goes, "Oh!" And he ran to him and realized that that was the relationship that they had.
Wow.
But he, because people in that civic synagogue thought that that's who they were because they saw us all the time with him on holidays and didn't see us any other time. And so we've created a chosen family, again, none of which share our last name or our names, and yet they're family in what family needs to be for each other. And I belong to many different communities, and ultimately, it's about making friends with myself and loving who I am and understanding that no one person can feed all of me and I need to feed myself more than anything else. No one community, because of who I am, can feed all of me, even if I grew up thinking and believing that to be the case. And so I'm fed by many different communities, and depending on what day of the year and depending on where I am, that's where I am.
And I noticed in Orthodoxy that Deborah Feldman wrote, I know it's not everybody's experience, but she had a lovely quote near the end of her book, and word for word I'm quoting, "God is no longer a prescription for paradise, but an ally in my heart," kind of a thing. So I wanted to, well, first of all, my guests on this show on Ask a Leader today are Hannah Databoy, Sarah Jones, and Hani Getter, talking about their leaving the Orthodoxy of Islam, Christian fundamentalism, and Hasidic Judaism, respectfully, here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and streaming on the web around the world at KUCI.org. And I want, if you could tell us there's two quick things here, quickly to answer these. Was your decision to become increasingly public an affirmation of yourself, a validation to like-minded individuals languishing in their insulation? Was it a combination of these, or was it entirely something else? Sarah, do you want to start with that?
Sure. It's for me, at least, it's probably born somewhat out of an activist impulse. I want people to know what it's actually like to grow up in Christian fundamentalism. I want people to know what it's actually like to grow up in Christian homeschooling, what it's like to be raised to believe that you're basically a warrior for Jesus, that your highest calling is to perpetuate culture war, and if you're a woman, to be submissive your entire life. I want people to know that that's real and it exists. But kind of playing out the idea of cultural, I also wanted to talk about it in order to get people to stop and just completely abandon this idea of culture war on both sides of the political spectrum, because it doesn't really help anybody. And I feel like children like I used to be, will continue to be caught in the middle. And if by sharing my story and my experiences with it, can get people to maybe second or think a bit more critically about the way that they approach the world, or about the way that they approach people who have beliefs and lives that are different from their own, then it's definitely worth it. And hopefully by being a bit more public, I've been able to do that.
Oh, fine. Hannah, mm-hmm. Next.
Well, it was a combination of the factors that you mentioned. In addition, it was also looking around at the communities that I found after I left Islam, namely, you know, the secular, atheist, and skeptical communities, and realizing that they were not, they were in name inclusive spaces for women and people of color and women of color, who those of us who are twofers that way. But there wasn't a lot of participation from women and people of color. And so I wanted to sort of lead the charge on that and sort of lead by example and try to make the spaces more inclusive and more intersectional.
And you talk about in your blog about it's about doing less harm.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Sort of it's not about denying that religious orthodoxy, but just moving into invigorating doing less harm. It's
yes.
a much general, more general application. Hani, please take the question. In terms of the where you're, you have enterprises you've actually formally founded around sort of taking your message outward. So how would you answer that question about what you're doing with your position?
You know, it really, I fell into it. I met some people camping and was just being me. And the next thing I know is I get a Facebook message from this woman asking me if I would be interviewed. And my response was, well, if you will put my practice in there and it'll get me some clients. I was just starting to build my practice at that time. Then I'll do it. It was really a business decision. It was like, okay.
Wow.
I need to build my practice, and I'm a life coach, and I help people through transitional spaces, and I'm really good at that. And so if this will help my practice, I'll do it. And what happened was that I got this outpouring of people, of messages, and thanking me for doing that, for speaking up. And I had no idea. I really kind of did not realize that that's what I was doing. It's like, okay, you want to interview me? Fine, here it is. But you have to make sure to put, you know, like it was just kind of like that.
Uh-huh.
And then here I was, and outside of what it did to my practice, what it really did was show me that I needed to be much more verbal than I was, and that I needed to do educational pieces, and that I needed to go out and speak, and that I needed to write, and that I needed to do public speaking. And so I began to do that as part of my practice. I do public speaking all over, and I've been called to different colleges because it was something that became a calling after that. And then there was this, I got an email from Columbia University students. One was a woman from Pakistan who was Muslim, and the other one was a woman from South Africa. Was Christian, and they emailed me asking if I would do this like video for them, a DVD. They were doing a documentary, and if I would be willing to be a part of it. And at first I was like, I do not have time for this. I'm a single mom. I'm working. I have a life. But I met with them, and their desire and was so clear about getting this message out and making sure people saw what was really happening and understanding the intricacies of what it's like for them. The movie was what it's like to be religious and come out as gay, and kind of like how does the religious community kind of deal with that when you're in such an insular community. And so it really came, the first call was really just a phone call. And then after that, it was, I need to keep doing this. And so my practice grew into becoming motivational speaking and writing and coaching, of course, which was so important to answer that call. And then 2 years ago, Footsteps reached out to me. Footsteps is founded by Malki Schwartz, who left the Chabad community. It's the sect of Hasidism.
Yes.
And so she they were looking for somebody to do some work up in Rockland, next to where I lived, and asked me, you know, to have a meeting with them. And when I realized the kind of work they were doing, again, I couldn't say no. I couldn't say no to be part of a community, to be part of a organization that helps people leave and gives them the tools to. I mean, when I left, there was nothing. I didn't know the first thing about education. I didn't know how to get it. I did a ton of research all on my own. And here somebody walks in and they're given the tools to help them through this transition.
Oh.
And every single person that walks through the doors of Footsteps are brave souls, people who are willing to just kind of step into the unknown. And so working with that, I run their family supports, and I run their Rockland group. And basically, the Rockland group is up in Rockland County, New York. And I run a support group, and I meet with people there. And then the family supports group is for people who are leaving marriages and or are in marriages, and one of them realizes that either they're an atheist or they don't believe in certain parts of the culture or something, and it just stops working. And so most of these marriages are arranged, and they have a lot of kids. And so, like, what do they do? And depending on what's happening in the community, we'll do everything to keep the children religious, even lie in court, so that the religious parent keeps the child, regardless of whether the other parent is male or female. It's the they want the religious parent to keep the children,
right,
so that they can raise them according to what they believe is best for their souls. And so speaking out and doing this kind of work, I had to do it. It was just something like, I remember a friend of mine once asked me, honey, why do you do this? Why do you keep putting yourself in the spotlight? And I turned to her and I said, will you? And she said, no. I'm like, well, then I got to do it.
Well, economically, as a recession-era grad, I have to say the hurdles are still there. My partner is disabled and unemployed, and we're navigating that, and I'm basically the sole source of support. But in terms of my life, my social life, my romantic life, you know, my family life, things are getting better. So, you know, I think I'm establishing a better emotional future. Financially, we'll see.
Sarah, how about you?
It's definitely easier than it was a few years ago. You know, I work for Americans United for Separation of Church now, so not only do I get to put my experiences to work, I feel like I have a chance to put them to work for a great organization that's doing important work on religious freedom. My personal relationships are indeed better. My family, my parents specifically, have at least accepted that, you know, I'm an atheist now, and this doesn't mean that, you know, I still don't care about them or that they don't care about me, but things are going to be different than they were, and my life is going to look very different than the one that they wanted for me. And my friendships, you know, I still have, it still affects my friendships in that most of my very close friends are ex-Christian fundamentalists too, because we all speak the same language, so to speak. Mm. And, you know, in my romantic life, I'm in a relationship now, and I'm very happy that, you know, some of the toxic attitudes I was raised with gender and relationships don't seem to have affected that.
Okay, good. Hani, want to wrap that up, and then we do the required reading list and plugging session. How is the train right at this point for you?
Really good.
Oh.
And I'll just leave it at that.
Good. So glad to hear that. I mean, and these folks, these paths aren't predetermined to be the outcomes that we're talking about now. It's just, there could even be more things around the corner. But this is the pronouncement that you all authentically give us, and it's reassuring in these anecdotal cases. Well, now, as I say, for the required reading, ladies, What sources, materials would you like to direct the listeners to? I know there's the inspirationallivinginc.com, and you've talked about footsteps.org. Just a few other things, Hani, before we ask Hannah and Sarah.
Yeah, so it's inspirationallivinginc.com, and it's footsteps.org.
Yes, exactly.
In terms of that, footsteps.org. In terms of books, I would suggest you read Unchosen, and also Leah Vincent's book,
Cut Me Loose. Yes, okay.
Right. So those are like two of my favorite books that I send people to. There's also a book called... Hush. Right.
Okay.
Those three books is what I would suggest. And of course, on the footsteps.org website, there's a lot more.
Okay, thank you. Hannah?
Well, I'm at Free Thought Blogs under the name Heinous Dealings. So it's freethoughtblogs.com/heinous. That's what it is. In terms of books, I'm working on A Skeptic's Guide to Islam that should be out probably early next year.
Oh, wow. Let's make sure that's a book signing right here. Let's do it.
That would be great.
Yes.
In terms of books, there's an anthology called Leaving Islam, Former Muslims Speak Out. It's edited by Ibn Warraq, but it has a lot of other people in it. There's not a whole lot out there by ex-Muslims that isn't by ones who have converted to Christianity, so that would be the one I would recommend.
Okay.
Oh, in addition, there's a blog that's also on the Free Thought Blogs network called Between a Veil and a Dark Place. And this woman, Hiba, is my peer, my friend, my colleague. I adore her. Mariam Namazi and Taslima Nasreen are also on the Free Thought Blogs network. We got a lot of ex-Muslim women on there.
Okay, they found that. You found that. Sarah, how about you?
Well, I blog regularly for Americans United, so our website is www.au.org, and I blog for Wall of Separation there, and I write for our magazine, Church and State, and I also write freelance for places like Religion News Service and The Guardian. As for resources that people should read, Homeschoolers Anonymous has a website, and I highly recommend that you check that out for more information, not just about homeschooling, but Christian fundamentalist culture in general. Books, I really appreciate Faithiest by Chris Dedman. And for more background research on the subject, Quiverful by Catherine Joyce is a great introduction, not just to the Quiverful subsect of Christianity,
Sarah,
which I didn't personally belong to,
Sarah,
but
because of
fundamentalism in general.
Because of the way the phone went, what's the title real clearly? I didn't get that.
Which book?
The last one.
Because there was Faithiest by
I have that one. The last one you mentioned. Core?
Right.
What's
Quiverful
it called?
By Catherine Joyce.
Quiverful.
So I didn't,
Quiverful.
I didn't
okay, that's what I wanted to get.
Yeah. It's I didn't grow up Quiverful, but it's still a great introduction to Christian fundamentalism and Christian homeschooling. So.
Okay, fine. Well, ladies, it's been a pleasure, and we all know there were a lot of other questions that I prepared and I wanted to bring in. I would like to have an opportunity, leave open the opportunity, give that distinct prospect to the listeners who are still tuned in, that where things develop in the future, that any one of you or all three of you might be available to come back to Ask a Leader. Is that a possibility?
It is for me, for sure.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, ladies, thank you so very much for being on the show today. I wanted to thank Hannah Dadaboy, Sarah Jones, and Hani Gedert talking about their leaving the orthodoxy of Islam, Christian fundamentalism, and Hasidic Judaism, respectively. And I want to wish Hani Gedert a very happy, meaningful new year. Thank you for coming, Hani, in the middle of the High Holy Days today. Hannah, thank you for coming. And Sarah, thanks, and have an interesting time in the workshops you're attending this week there in D.C. Thanks for coming on
all
the
right,
show, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you all. All the best. Well, that, folks, is the end of the show. I'm going to be on... Real People of OC on Kimberly Martin's show. I'll be hosting Penelope Collins, professor of UCI School of Education. She'll talk about a new undergraduate major program. And then we'll get to hear from Daniel Bravo and hopefully his brother Luis, two dreamers who've been cleared Their paperwork's cleared through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals paperwork with some major updates on their situation. Next week and all the way through November 4th, the elections, that is, Ask a Leader will cover local politics. Enough of those pesky mailers we're receiving. Let's hear it from the horses' mouths. Next week, I'll bring on Orange County Register of Voters Neil Kelly, and then all three mayoral candidates for Irvine. That's Marianne Guido, Stephen Choi, and Catherine Daigle. Talk with you next week. Thank you for listening.